Looking ahead, the Fed, every time it got in trouble, it could slash rates, and it had a tailwind at its back. It had a tailwind of globalization. We now have a headwind of deglobalization smack in the face of the Fed, and that deglobalization is inflationary. The Fed's got its work cut out, Adam. Serious work.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. Beset now by raging inflation and supply shortages, governments around the world are scrambling to bring prices down and protect their economies. And this is leading to a number of truly bad ideas, like price controls, that have a proven track record of failing every time in history they've been tried. But hey, when times get desperate, politicians make desperate decisions. So how will things get brought under control? I'm excited to discuss this with Mike Shedlock, better known as Mish across financial media. He publishes a tremendous volume of daily macro observations at his site, mishtalk.com. I've known him well for over a decade, and I'm glad he was finally able to appear on Wealthion as a guest. Mish, it's fun to finally get you on the program. Thanks so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be on. Hey, thanks for inviting me to be on Wealthion. I'm really looking forward to it. And folks, we're just going to have fun. Adam and I are just going to kick around some ideas, what we think is happening, where the market's going, and you know where we are in the shape of this bear market. So, Adam, what's on your mind here?
Well, I got a number of questions here for you, Mike, but if you don't mind, I'd like to start with the one that I like to ask everybody that comes on Wealthion, because I know that a lot of folks, including your followers in particular, be interested in hearing your high-level thoughts on this. And it's a general question. What is your current assessment of today's global economy and financial markets?
Oh, well, the first one's easy, assessment of the global economy. I think we're heading into a recession. In fact, I think it's likely that China is there. Europe is there. We had this big debate back in 2008, as you might remember, that the U.S. was going to head in recession and China somehow was going to, you know, buck the trend and decouple. The argument seems to be in reverse now, and I don't buy that either, Adam. The U.S. is not going to decouple from the global economy here and be strong. If China is weak, if Europe is weak, with oil prices rising, just pull up a chart of oil prices and oil shocks and look how closely they tie to a recession. So, we had a massive run-up in the stock market, and we're going to have demand destruction. And unfortunately, that's about the only way I see the Fed can control inflation here is by crushing the stock market.
All right, great. Well, I want to dig into that with you. It's on my list here. Let's start with a topic that you've just written about recently. I just made a comment on this the other day about how, I'm going to put this under the umbrella of we're from the government and we're here to help, right? during the 2020 crisis, the Fed and Congress stepped in and collectively pumped over $10 trillion of stimulus into the system, right? And, you know, in large part, I think that that's just what politicians and government leaders do when they get caught by surprise, is they just spend a ton of money, in this case, a historically unprecedented amount of money, to look like they're doing something about the problem. And really, kind of consequences be damned, it's just, hey, we want to justify our roles here. We got to look like we're doing something to address this. And then, of course, when the inflation came down the road, manifested later on, of course, the reaction is, well, nobody could have predicted this, right? Well, of course, it was imminently predictable to folks like us. So the theme here is sort of, the government makes decisions oftentimes for imperfect reasons that we all end up paying a larger price for down the road. So I want to take that comment and drill into some things you wrote about, I think just today even, where the government's now talking about price controls, specifically on gas, And then there's a larger sort of multinational oil buying cartel that's being proposed. So why don't we start with those price controls on gas? How well do you think those are going to work out, Mike?
Well, first of all, they're not going to pass, which in some ways, things are so stupid that you almost wish they would try them, you know, just so you can prove to them how stupid they are. But this will never fly in the Republican Senate. I mean, the House is probably going to pass something. It won't fly in the face of the Senate, so it's just going to die. But price controls have always been a bad idea. But the way this one was organized is actually especially stupid. The bill was written to exempt the small gas stations, and actually, you know, something like 95% of the stations are like, you know, family owned. It's not like,
yeah,
a big
like
chain.
Mom and pops, right? Yeah.
Yeah. You see the name out there, Shell, but that station isn't owned by Shell or Marathon or whatever. They just rent that name. They lease that name, and they can sell under that brand name. So, you know, exempting all of these, but cutting out the 5% that is controlled by big oil interests, well, that's going to reduce supply by what, 5%, right? So meanwhile, we've got diesel prices and gas prices at an all-time high. The bill, if implemented, would actually reduce supply. And of course, perhaps by far more than anyone thinks, because the oil producers aren't just going to start selling oil for a loss just to be nice. So, and then in Europe, I mean, this is amazing that someone could even propose this, but Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi, he used to be the head of the ECB, by the way, he ought to know something about this. He proposed having a buyer's cartel here, in which somehow all the buyers of oil would get together and demand that Saudi Arabia or whoever would produce more oil. Meanwhile, back in the US, Team Biden is doing everything it can to shut down production of more oil. So how is this supposed to work? You know, it's literally crazy. But let's step back for a moment. Yeah, you know, Congress did three rounds of stimulus. And actually, Trump wanted a bigger round of stimulus than he got through. So it's not just the Democrats here, it's both parties. But if you want to point the finger at someone, the Fed at least should have seen the impact of quantitative easing at a time when there's fiscal and monetary stimulus. Okay, let's say they didn't see it, and it's clear they didn't. But then even in the face of inflation going up and up and up and up and up, they kept this message that inflation was transitory with all of this money pouring in. And still the final kicker on all of this is they kept QE going until the very bitter end. They kept QE going all the way to March of 2022. So what the Fed did is inexcusable. Of course, Biden now is, you know, blaming Russia and Putin, even though that most of this was happening as a result of three rounds of stimulus. I mean, Biden didn't invade Ukraine, excuse me, Putin didn't invade Ukraine until, what, February 24th of this year? And prices had been, you know, rising all this time. The Fed ignored it. Of course, the president's going to ignore it. You got to really blame the Fed here. Hard.
Yeah. And, you know, when you talk about the Fed doing QE all through last year, I mean, it wasn't just doing a little QE. It was doing $120 billion a month, right? I mean, that's over a trillion, well over a trillion for the year alone, right? So, yeah, I mean, this is sort of the theme that I want to tug on here, which is, our authorities are oftentimes taking extreme actions on issues that they actually don't have a lot of control over, right? And so, you know, their actions create all these, you could call them unintended consequences, or just, you know, the consequences of poor decisions.
People claim it's on purpose. I'm not in that group, but that is a claim, Adam.
Yeah, no, it is, and I mean, I guess you can understand it because a lot of this stuff seems so boneheaded. It's hard to imagine that they can be as clueless as they are at times, but I think we are continuing to be the collateral damage of this. Hey, we're here from the government. We're from the government. We're here to help. I'm actually going to put up a demotivational poster on the screen here. It's one of my favorites, and I'm doing it from memory, but folks can read it live on the screen here. But it's something like it says, "Government." If you hate the problems we create, just wait till you get a load of our solutions, right? And I want to go from there into Powell's press conference last week, where he said two things that are notable. I was actually a little, pleasantly surprised on the first one he said, where he admitted that the Fed has no control over the supply side. So he said, "We're only going to focus on demand." And he's very specific about, look, we're laser focused on bringing demand down. We got to cool off the froth in the jobs market. He was super focused on that, but basically saying like, look, we're going to hike interest rates. We're going to keep on hiking them because we got to bring demand down to begin to tame inflation. And to a certain extent, I think the mantra of don't fight the Fed does apply. If you shorted the Fed over the past 10 years, you got killed. I think the Fed's pretty serious, at least for the near term, that it's going to continue going after bringing demand down, and I think we're already beginning to see some initial, elements here of demand destruction. If you look at the used car market, you look at a few other places, you look at what's happening with consumer debt, that type of stuff. But the Fed does not have any control over things like the cost of fuel, the cost of food, stuff like that, that are due to these shortages. First created by COVID, but now obviously created by the entire reshuffling of world trade, given all the embargoes against Russia now. So, the Fed is basically, tightening. They're now going on a tightening campaign right at the time where multiple markets are correcting. Right, we've got stocks down big, we've got bonds down big. It's really one of the worst years ever for both of them together. Housing looks set to really cool off here, and I think we can have an interesting discussion if you like later on here about the potential for a pretty serious housing correction. And you said you think we're going into recession. I agree with you. That
We might
generally
be there.
means we may
We
already be
might
there.
already be there.
Yeah, but a real and prolonged recession oftentimes has a lot of job losses that come along with it too, right? So my point here is the Fed may be doing its something to help. Leaning right into, they should have done it a year ago or more, like you said, but they're doing it now where they may be really exacerbating the train of pain that's already pulling into the station here. What do you think?
Well, one thing to keep in mind is, and I've not heard anyone say it this way, or very few people anyway, is the Fed is pro-cyclical. Here we are, they are now hiking interest rates into a global slowdown. And when things were going gangbusters, they were loosening rates and had QE. So Bernanke said something, I think it was in 2010. We won't make famous last words. We won't make the same mistake again about asset bubbles. Well, guess what? They made a bigger mistake with asset bubbles. This is the biggest asset bubble in history. So the Fed is going to try and curtail demand. In a lot of ways, it's not going to be easy. In some ways, it will. They can certainly curtail demand to buy houses, and they can certainly curtail with interest rate hikes the desire to build houses. But what does that do for rent? Rent prices have gone through the moon, and I don't believe for one second, I doubt you do either, but rent prices are only going up 4.8% year over year, and owner's equivalent rent that's is only going up 4.8% a year. Those two things are 31% of the CPI. Well, guess what? If rent is not fully priced in and they keep going up, it's going to be hard to bring down the CPI. If the Fed curtails the production of houses, well, guess what? That curtails the demand to buy a house. And that means people are going to rent longer, right? The only thing the Fed has going for it here right now, I think Lynn Alden might have talked about this. I've talked about it. So it's calculated risk. And that is the sheer number of homes under construction that are still in the pipeline. Is that enough to bring rent prices down? Is that construction in the right places, or is it like scattered in little pockets that are just going to affect the prices in little pockets? I don't think anyone knows that, but it just highlights the problem ahead of the Fed. And of course, with the war in Ukraine, fertilizer prices are going up. Brazil, Africa, lots of nations are using less fertilizer. We've actually had destruction of crops in Ukraine, something like, I'm going to make up a number here, but I think it's close, 30% of the wheat exports in the world come from Ukraine. Another 8% come from India. And guess what India just did? India banned wheat exports, or at least put some controls on them. So it's every country for itself. We've gone from and this is the big thing the Fed is fighting. And I don't believe we can stress this enough. We've gone from just in time, you know, production with global wage arbitrage to every country for itself. The USA wants USA first. Germany has always been Germany first. China, of course, has always been China first. But every country wants to be me first now. That's mathematically impossible, right? So the consumer of last resort is still the U.S. consumer. So these are the forces. But looking ahead, the Fed, every time it got in trouble, it could slash rates, and it had a tailwind at its back. It had a tailwind of globalization. We now have a headwind of deglobalization smack in the face of the Fed, and that deglobalization is inflationary. The Fed's got its work cut out, Adam. Serious work.
Yeah, and so you just underscored the reason behind my question here, which is, we could really be entering in a very painful period, era of stagflation, right, where the Fed is successful in basically, destroying demand destruction where it can, right? So economic growth is coming down, economic opportunity is coming down, people are potentially getting laid off, whatever, right? But it feels like a bad recession, right, economic-wise. But to your point, there's all these factors that are outside of their control that are keeping prices high, right? So it's the worst of both worlds, right?
Yeah, this is the first time, by the way. Anyone who's followed me over the years knows that I've been a
deflationist,
forever, a staunch yes. deflationist, and I've been right. And but when I started looking at deglobalization, what's going on? Now we can debate how long this lasts. But that is a huge headwind in the face of the Fed in terms of what it can be able to do. On the other hand, though, the Fed is not going to let the credit markets blow up. So far, it's been orderly. And you can look at the declines in the stock market. Every day I look, been no gap downs. I'm a big firm believer in technical analysis where these gaps tend to fill. Most of the decline in these stocks, and especially in the indexes, even today, a gap down, went rallied back up, filled the gap. And this is what's been going on for weeks. So and that's another thing too. When I look at like daily chart, God, it's almost shocking how far some of these stocks have fallen. But you pull up a weekly or a monthly chart, what have we done? We've taken back a year and a half, maybe, except in something like ARC. That's it. I think we're going to unwind the whole thing. I'm seriously think that a 50% haircut in the S&P. And so by that measure, we're not, are we even in bear market territory on the S&P? We certainly are on the NASDAQ.
Right. But we're close on the S&P. I don't think we're at 20 just yet.
I'm expecting a rally here. People have been saying this actually for weeks, but I keep saying, well, you know, be careful about this because oversold can last a really long time in a bear market, just as overbought can be last a really long time in a bull market. But at a technical support level, I had a line right around, 3,800 or so on the S&P. Looks like we're going to get there sooner or later. Probably bounce off of that, but where to? You know, the longer term, if you're a believer in technical analysis, and I am, I'm looking at 3,200 on the S&P as the first level that has a chance of holding, more likely something around the 2,400 level. Who's prepared for that? What are pension plans going to do? Of course, I saw some posts today from the obvious names here. We need to do something to protect the pension plans. Yeah, we should. What we actually should do is have bankruptcy reform and let Illinois go bankrupt.
I didn't even have pensions on my list, but I think I'm going to add it now, Mike. All right. Well, so let's stay for a second on what's happening with the markets. Okay. If I hear what you're saying is you're saying, hey, look, for all the fundamental reasons you and I have talked about over the years and that I talk every week with the guests on this program, there's lots and lots of reasons to say the market's got incredibly overvalued and fair value is still a lot lower than where we are today, even though we've had such a bad start to the year so far. And you just gave a couple of good targets there. It's so funny, 2,400. I mean, I can make a case for even lower than that.
Sure.
And I'm sure you can too. But I'm just telling you, most people right now, their brains can't even conceive the market going that low from here. Just because faith in buying the dip and the markets only go up and all that stuff is now so ingrained after 12 years of nothing but liquidity force feeding, by the Fed here. So, just to sort of give a sense for how people are still so sort of oblivious to what may be happening in front of our eyes right now, I've talked about a lot of the data that basically, convinces me that recession's very likely and that we've got tougher times ahead. I call it a parade of horribles. On your site, I found another list of your parade of horribles, and I want to read through it because it makes a good point at the end. Fed hiking at the fastest pace since 1980s. CPI up 8.5% from a year ago. 30-year mortgage rate 5.4%, basically double what it was a year ago. Just-in-time manufacturing morphs into supply hoarding. War in Ukraine continues to disrupt shipping channels in world trade. European energy crunch, falling stock market, demand destruction, recession. Then you say, which of these does not fit in? And the last one on the list is S&P earnings estimates for 2022 have increased from $200 to $226 a share, and similar increase for the 2003 estimated earnings. Earning estimates jump almost 10% versus 2022. So we've got this unbelievably bad, list of unfolding developments, and yet the analysts are saying, it's going to be even better next year.
It's incredible. The earnings game is such a rig anyway. But what's shocking actually is that how long they're holding on to this meme. Now, what tends to happen is once they go the other direction, They will cut them purposely, by the way. In fact, that's a game they play every month. They always try and come out with a number that they think that the street can beat, right? So, and the street beats earnings estimates, even in falling markets, actually something like 85% of the time, 80 something, I forget the exact number. But, it's a rigged game. Analysts purposely try and come up with numbers, and yet sometimes the analysts are like really shocked. They thought that was it Coin, I think, or the earnings were going to fall by a penny, and it fell by $1.97. A loss of $1.97 a share. So things are really blowing up here, and people are still complacent. I actually read on people are bullish as ever on crypto. You know, I'm never selling. Okay, maybe they aren't.
All right. And by the way, that's next on my list. So let's dive into that here. So talking about things blowing up, you know, the cryptocurrency complex has been taken out to the woodshed more than any other sector in the past month.
Yeah.
Keep going.
So the holders, HOLDR, you know, that HOLD, you know, came about. Somebody was drunk and said, I'm holding forever. And so that's now a meme, right? HODL instead of HOLD. But okay, I believe some of these people. In fact, most of them probably are going to hold. But what's the marginal buyer going to do? What's the guy that, because that's where the demand is, that's where the price is going to be set, the marginal buyer and seller. You know, these people who bought last year at 60,000, are they panicking now here at 30? What about the people that bought at 45? Or even what about the people who bought at 30 and saw it rise all the way up to 65,000 or 66, whatever it was? And now they're back at 30 or 29 or 28, hit 26 today, by the way. What are those people going to do? Some of them, a fair number of them, the Johnny come latelys are going to exit. And, you know, what about the hedge funds? This is kind of interesting. We got Bitcoin futures now. So, you know, for all of this, you know, mining and everything and anti, you know, dollar, anti fiat, anti everything, you know, all the Bitcoin community, you know, praised Bitcoin futures. Well, you know, what happens if hedge funds start shorting the damn thing right when there's a margin call at 21,000, you know, which is where we're going to see one actually on Bitcoin. So, you know, this stuff doesn't add up. And I don't know the fundamentals. I'm sorry. No matter what anyone tells me, Bitcoin has nothing at all to do with transactions. It has everything to do with just being part of the huge speculative mania bubble that the Fed blew, no more, no less.
Right, and I know we're going to get tons of comments from the crypto
community. Oh, I'm sure we are.
I know you will. Yeah. And what's been interesting to me is I've been trying to educate myself more this year about the crypto space. I've had a couple of experts on, and what's interesting to me about let's say about the Bitcoin community, this is sort of one of the early ahas I had when I was really rolling up my sleeves in here, is they kind of abandoned, they've all kind of abandoned the coin part about Bitcoin, you know, the alternative digital currency. You know, most of them have said, yeah, you know what, it's probably not going to scale. It's not going to take over the dollar as the world reserve currency. Not everyone's given up that ghost, but I would say the majority of the longtime Bitcoin, you know, thought leaders have pretty much abandoned that, and it's come down to the store of value side of things. Now, obviously, hard to make that case in a year where, you know, Bitcoin's down almost 40% now, and it's been gyrating as wildly as it has. It's not a great store of value, right? But what's interesting to me is if speculation drives it, which it has to date in terms of its pricing, right? Because it's a hard thing to value. You can't just, you know, plot out a bunch of cash flows and discount them back. Mm-hmm. Then emotion and sentiment plays a big role, and that's great on the way up if you're hodling, right? And you know, it's a mania, but it bites you on the way down, right? So you have that sentiment, and then you've had things recently happen, like the breakdown of the stablecoin Terra that happened this week, where it broke the buck, right? And even Tether broke the buck very briefly over the past 24 hours. It recovered super quickly, but that's got to do some damage to confidence and to sentiment here, right? So you've got that sentiment risk. And then on the other side, you have risks that I don't think the community's faced very often. You just talked about sort of institutions, now that there's a futures exchange, being able to come in and take short positions and push it around. But you also mentioned margin calls. So if you could just give a little bit of detail on this, because you've written about it, but you know, Michael Saylor, who has the fund MicroStrategy, has been you know, one of the biggest Bitcoin buyers out there. And he's said publicly at some point in the past that given his average price for Bitcoin and the debt that he used to buy a good chunk of it, that if it drops below a certain value, and I think it was $21,000 a coin, that he might have to start getting margin calls. Is that accurate?
Yes. Actually, he didn't say that. He tried to diffuse that. It was his, I believe, CFO, chief financial officer, who said that, and it was in response to a direct question. And the answer was, you know, based on the agreement with the lender, that if Bitcoin fell to 21,000, there would be a margin call. Now, the CEO came in and said, well, and he didn't say that wasn't accurate. He just said, we can always provide more collateral. Yeah. And of course, they've got a lot of Bitcoin, you know, that he's bought as collateral. And the average price is, I believe, somewhere around $30,000. So he's, you know, right about even. But remember, he took out a loan to buy more of it at that average price. So the share price of MicroStrategy, or the company itself, MSTR, is a symbol, it hit 1300 or so not that long ago, and it's fallen precipitously. I didn't look at the price today, you know, $100, a couple hundred dollars, something like that.
$170 this year.
175. Okay. The he's turned this company into a leveraged speculative play on Bitcoin. And guess what? This isn't the first time this man has blown up the exact same company. In 2000, he was forced to, admitted that they overstated earnings, that, you know, right at the peak of the dot-com bubble, March of 2000, they turned earnings into a loss. There was a fraud investigation by the SEC on him. And they settled the same way they normally do. He paid some sort of trivial fine, $100 million or something. Meanwhile, he made $1 billion off of this deal. And here he's done it again. You know, he's literally bet the entire company on a margin position, on a loan. And if this guy is so brilliant, he was cheered when he did this, right? He was cheered on this announcement by the Bitcoin community. They really should have been horrified. You know, here we are, you know, talking about, you know, leverage speculative betting, and that, you know, that you're cheering on this guy. And you know what? If he hits a margin call at 21, I think it's likely. I did a poll on it, and it's something like 20% of the people think it's never going to happen. And then on the other side of the coin, we got a guy named goes by the name of Crypto Whale, who posts on Twitter. That's his handle. You know, he's the other extreme. He goes, I know that Bitcoin is going to fall below 10,000 this year. And he said, I will give $1,000 in Bitcoin to anyone who retweets this. So, of course, I retweeted it, and I added a comment to my tweet, and I said, will you sign a contract on this? And, of course, he did not respond. So I'm trying to be neutral here. I mean, the people that say it's impossible for this, you know, chain reaction to happen are wrong. It is very, very possible. And to say that you know that it's going to happen, well, that's the other extreme. And if you get into any of these debates on Twitter, you know, you know, you're just attacked like you're an idiot just for simply saying something very simple. Like I said, I don't know where this is going, and nor does anyone else.
Yeah, well, the problem is it's become a religion to a lot of people here, and both on the tech side, but also those that did buy in and are now hodling. and are now sitting on pretty big losses, you know, it challenges their, it triggers their anxieties that they might have made a really bad decision. So they're just trying to fight that insight from entering their brain. I went to Reddit's Dogecoin board yesterday and actually felt pretty guilty. I felt like I was sort of rubbernecking at a horrible highway fatality. Mm-hmm. But you know, that when I was there, the coin was down to 8 cents and mm-hmm. it had gotten as high as 70 cents or so, you know, a year ago. Mm-hmm. And it may be a preview of what you're talking about, Mish, where, you know, people are just coming to terms with, you know, oh my God, I was part of the movement. We were going to the moon, you know, Elon was had our back and we were going to, you know, we were going to
be the next reserve currency.
Yeah, mean, exactly.
People thought disrupt.
That's what I was looking for. We're going to disrupt the monetary system. And now they're like, oh my God, I'm sitting on these horrific losses. And a lot of these people, you know, younger people, they didn't have a lot of money to put in, but the money they put in was a big chunk of whatever their investable net worth was. And it's sort of vaporizing now. So it's a real risk. Like you said, look, is Bitcoin going to, you know, drop to $1,000? Yeah, who knows?
Let's discuss for a second how that happens, because I was challenged on this. You know, someone, you know, said, Mish, you know, you're wrong that this cascade isn't going to happen. And this is the reason. I've looked at the order books, you know, and, you know, there's, you know, people going to buy in at this level, this level, this level, this level, what? Okay.
Well, right, but just know we're inviting the complete wrath of the crypto community.
Yeah, go ahead. I know we are. And but okay, so there's a margin call at 21,000. So he pledges more Bitcoin. Okay, now people are going to know where that next margin call is going to be. If the price starts falling, you know, especially after it breaks and breaks that first one hard, you know, are people really going to want to step in? And then I'm wondering how much of this order book is even real, but you know, how often have we heard about, you know, fake order books, right? But let's assume that they are real. One thing that's not on the order book is the level at which people panic, and no one knows what that level is. But someone who bought in at 40 and it falls to 25, you know, that might not be in the order book, you know, for them to sell, you know. So, but when it hits 25, they can't take it anymore and they sell. And then the next person, you know, comes in and buys the dip and says, oh, well, you know, I'll control my loss and I'll put in a stop loss order $1,000 lower. Well, when that loss hits, and guess who knows where these order books are, by the way, it's the people running the futures markets, right? You know, they know where the real orders are. So, and they run stops all the time in both directions. So, you know, now we've got some charges of manipulation coming down on this. So, you know, to say, you know, for sure that, this level of triggering or cascading can't fall smack in the face of Luna and Dogecoin and otherwise. Oh, but here's what's in their minds, Adam. It's, you know, Bitcoin is real. The rest of these are S coins, right? You know, Bitcoin is the savior and it can't happen to Bitcoin. That is exactly the way the community believes.
Yeah. And that's the kind of hubris that kills all investors in a bad market. And you know, just one more risk factor to add in there too is, you know, it may be a drawdown in a different asset that actually starts impacting Bitcoin. So in other words, like, let's say you're a hedge fund and you're big into tech and all things tech and disruptive. And, you know, you had a huge position in Netflix. Maybe it was levered and you wake up one day and, you know, Netflix disappoints and it's down 30% like it was, you know, not that long ago. And all of a sudden you get to sell anything, right? Basically as collateral to try to, you know, keep your fund alive, right? Yes. So you might start having to dump your big Bitcoin, you know? So anyways, it's just the point being is your point, the entire risk set is not on the book, right? It's right. There are a lot of different factors that can come into play. Two things I want to say. One is, look, I'm not trying to beat up on Bitcoin here. And could this be just one of the 80% drawdowns that Bitcoin has had along its lifetime? And then we're off to the races after this. Absolutely. Totally open to that possibility.
I agree. And I've never said, except in the very beginning, I never said otherwise. And I've And I admitted very early on, actually, Bitcoin was under 1,000. I just never thought that it would get, you know, to these heights. So certainly I've been wrong about, you know, how high it was going and where it was going. But, you know, the galling thing to me has always been people who say, I know it was going to go up
there. Right. And I think that's what we're warning people is it's less what you don't know that gets you in trouble. It's the things you know for sure that get you.
things you think you know for sure. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And obviously I'm stealing that from, I think, Mark Twain or whoever was the smarter person initially say it. The other thing I want to say on this topic, and then I want to hop onto a few others real quickly, Mike, is, you know, speaking for myself, you know, I completely agree that blockchain technology is very disruptive. I have, you know, pretty good confidence that a lot of today's commerce is going to move on that platform tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I've had experts on talking about what they call about sort of phase two cryptos, which are, it's not just a speculative token. It's actually more like a share in a company. It's think of it as almost as like a blockchain version of a share of stock. And it's and these are companies that have real revenues, real cash flows. They're doing real things in the real world better than they could be done in the analog world or in the web 2.0 world. So I'm not trying to diminish the opportunity set there. I think what I will say is, if that interests you at all, check out the video I recorded recently with Stephen McBride on the topic. And the only thing I'll say is I imagine that a lot of the types of companies that he was talking about, those phase two cryptos, are at even better valuations now. So if you find you like the opportunity offered by that sector, well, we may be getting into the territory of some pretty interesting entry prices there for the long haul. You know, maybe they're still
That's entirely possible. And if you think back to, you know, the dot-com bust back all the way back in 2000, you know, there were some exciting technologies, but, you know, the products and the earnings and stuff weren't there with, you know, wireless, and we had promises of all kinds of stuff. And guess what? Eventually some of that stuff, you know, played out. The problem was picking the survivors, because there were a lot of companies, Global Crossing, Enron, WorldCom, you know, where, you know, people thought would rule the world, JDSU went absolutely bankrupt, went just totally, completely bankrupt. You know, some of those, you know, really, really blew up. So there's going to be some winners here. And I think the big mistake will probably be thinking that yours is the one. And that's what we're seeing right now, you know, with, you know, Bitcoin. You know, it's, you know, what if it's Ether? What if it's something else that's not even out there yet?
Right. That one true token mentality, it can only be this one, is what gets everybody into trouble, whether it's a token or a stock or whatever. All right. So two quick topics I'd love to get into before we wrap it up. I want to go back to pensions just for a moment. So I interviewed a guy, I'll put up a link to it here because it's a fascinating discussion, named Ted Seidel, who holds the record for the largest like pension whistleblower award. He understands the pension system really well. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I interviewed him, golly, I mean, this was right around or right before the pandemic hit. So, I mean, this was a while ago. And he was saying back then, that our pensions, many, many pensions were, you know, skirting with insolvency back then, with how poorly funded they were. I can imagine that it's only becoming a lot more acute now with the losses that we've suffered so far this year. And Ted said something really interesting. He said, there's basically three ways that a pension can get into trouble. You can put too little in, and you can take too much out, right? And those are the ones that most people sort of think of. But in the middle, it's how the money's managed while it's there. And that was the most eye-opening part about the discussion with him, because he was like, the capital is so poorly managed in so many of these pension funds for a variety of reasons, but one of them being, you know, a number of the people on the boards of these pensions are being pulled from like the unions or whatever that they benefit. And these are people who do not have a tremendous amount of investing background, right? So they're relatively naive and they're kind of, you know, sheep for the fleecing by the Wall Street guys that come in and sell them on all the products that should be in the pension fund, right? There's also a lot of cronyism where, you know, they're funding stadiums in their city or stuff like that, which just tend to be big boondoggles for all the developers, and you know, obviously end up costing way more and they turn out not to be profitable. But he basically said that we're doing a really bad job of mismanaging this stuff. So, you know, back to my point about how things must be there like now, you know, I got to imagine if things continue the way they're going, we're probably not all that far away from beginning to get the news that like, this pension's getting into trouble and whatnot. Do you think that the government's just going to come back and ride to the rescue with bailouts galore again here? Or what do you think about the pension landscape? Because you just moved out of the state with one of the very worst systems, Illinois.
Yes, and I know a lot about Illinois. I don't know so much about others. I do know that Kentucky is also particularly bad. Just on sheer size, though, Illinois is is the biggest of the messes. California, perhaps. There's one more point I would like to add. That actually is a driver for these funds to do bad things, and that is pension plan assumptions. The pension plan assumptions have been 6.5, 7. Some of them are probably still floating with 8% because that is the number that they need to be able to make their drawdowns. So one of the things that some of them have been doing is leveraging into bonds. And I've not heard anything about this, but this is going to be rather interesting. If, you know, someone levered into 10-year bonds, what's going to happen? Or even worse, levered into junk, because that is guaranteed to not come back here. So the entire 60-40 portfolio thing, I don't think we've ever seen losses like we're seeing right now. So even for someone managing their own money, it has been, you know, pretty, pretty brutal. And on top of all of that, in spite of this massive rally, I don't know how other use the word over and over again, but from 2000 to 12-year rally, pension plans like the state of Illinois have actually been losing money every year to what you said, drawdowns and not enough money coming in and bad management. They've not even seen a down market. It won't take a 40% decline in the S&P to bankrupt these pension plans. If the S&P were just to be flat here for the next 5 years, all of these pension plans, almost all of them, are in deep, serious trouble.
And as you and I know, our good friend of both of ours, John Hussman, you know, his models predict basically flat to negative returns on average.
For 12 years.
So you were being generous there with 5. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. Okay. So you're underscoring, you know, what I was hoping you would, which is, hey, look, the risk here is actually really pretty big.
I didn't answer one question though. Did you ask me, or maybe it's just in my mind, did you ask me, you know, when does the Fed step in, or was that a later question?
Oh, I did ask about bailouts, but I'm kind of going there. So let me tee it up for you, and then you answer that, which is, so if these funds do get into trouble, and if we do have bailouts for them, and I'm sure to a certain extent there's going to have to be, it creates this really interesting social schism, if you will, where, you know, right now with rates as low as they are, having a pension is like having millions of dollars in the bank at today's rates, right? So it's a tremendous advantage over the guy who doesn't have a pension, right?
Exactly.
And we know the numbers, the vast majority of Americans have almost no savings for retirement. Right. And even those who do and have saved up a lot, you know, a couple million bucks, their yield is still much less than what most people are getting in an annual pension, right? So if we enter this sort of, you know, really stagflationary future, or just, you know, it can be disinflation or deflation, whatever, but where, you know, households are still really pinched, asset prices have come down, and all of a sudden there are big taxpayer funded bailouts for the pension funds, I think it really is going to light a match to a certain extent socially, where people are going to say, wait a minute, you know, that guy's been benefiting already. I worked really hard too. I didn't get a pension. And now that I'm hurting, you are increasing my taxes to protect their pension and I got to pay for it. Right. So I don't want to say whether it's good or bad. I'll let people infer, you know, come up with their own side of that argument. I just think that that collision could really be a real potential here. Do you think so?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the question is, how likely is that, and in what time frame? Actually, that's two questions. If the Democrats were in control of the House and the Senate and the executive, there's no question they would do this. They would bail out the unions in 1 second flat. The in a House divided, I don't know what the likelihood of any of this is. Certainly in states that are, you know, not union, don't have a lot of union workers, and the public pensions, you know, aren't there, they're not going to want to bail out Illinois and California. They're not going to. So the question of when and how fast or if anything is done is going to depend on who's in control here. And from where I sit, my political take here is that it's kind of interesting if you want to play. I don't want to dwell too much in politics. We have people fanning the flames here otherwise. But in some ways, Republicans ought to be happy that they did not, that Trump did not win, because we would have the same amount of inflation now, or almost as much. They would be getting the blame. Instead of in November, Democrats being voted out of office, Republicans would be. It was sort of a Pyrrhic victory here, actually, for Biden to have won. Is what I expect now, and I expect a slaughter in the midterms. And let's assume that I'm right, or you can make, you know, whatever assumptions you want. The Republicans will control the House. So this stuff probably not going to pass then, especially if Republicans get control of the Senate. But you know what? If things get bad enough and everyone's screaming, but will everyone be screaming, or will it just be the unions and the pension plans that are screaming? So I'm not sure we get to that point where Congress is willing to do much, but certainly that's going to add to the us versus them thing. More polarization is coming in the United States. This is just another, grounds for it. And then, you know, meanwhile, on the stagflationary side, I mean, this idea that we can just cut off energy and stop producing fossil fuels, we're going to terminate natural gas, and magically we're going to have enough lithium and manganese and nickel and copper and everything else, and aluminum even, to build the windmills that only work when wind is blowing. I think we're in for a reckoning in more ways than one here, Adam. It's sad, but the result to me, no matter which side you're on here, screams of more polarization, Adam.
Yeah, sadly, I'm inclined to agree with you there, Mike. And a lot of that goes back to kind of the magical thinking, you nailed it, of governments, and hey, we're here to help, and we're going to do a bunch of things that make us look like we're important, and you know, we're earning our keep, when in fact they're just creating bigger and bigger problems that become intractable. And we're kind of now at the point where they've piled up so much, it's the can can't be kicked very far down the road anymore, and that just places more and more stress on the system, and a lot of those factors end up placing more and more stress on society, increasingly, you know, at war with itself. You talked about globalization turning into every nation for itself. You know, sadly, as pressures go on society, it tends to have the chance of balkanizing as well, which is very sad. So, anyways, I don't want to end on a negative note like this, but I do get to end because we're getting near the hour. So real quick, and I just a minute answer on this, Mike. We'll go into it more deeply next time we have you on. Thoughts on gold? Because I know that you write about gold from time to time, and we talk about it a fair amount here on the program.
I've just recently written a post, and I didn't post it on Twitter, but it's actually posted on my blog. You know, people have this conception here that what's holding back now gold is the dollar. But if you look, and I'm just gonna speak some prices here off the top of my head, you know, with a US dollar index, you know, at let's say 87, gold's been at like 350, 500, 850, 2000, 1500. So, you know, this idea that gold depends on the dollar is mistaken. It depends, and I believe I can show this with charts and have in my blog that it's really dependent on faith in central banks. What I think's happening now is, you know, gold's been rising actually for the last couple of years until recently. And you know, it's not that people are having faith in the Fed per se, but I think people are like, you know, tossing away everything that you mentioned here earlier. I don't put predictions on the price of gold. I don't claim to know where it's going. I just believe and have for a long time, and it's served me well, that over time it's going to go up. Now that means you're going to have to trade in and out of miners. I didn't do it this last time, unfortunately. I, you know, certainly wish I sold about a few weeks ago, but I didn't.
Well, now you're a minor holder.
Now I'm a minor holder. I mean, you know, but I trade in and out of them, and I have other things. And maybe we should, you know, talk about that in the next interview, because there are opportunities outside the gold, there are opportunities outside the US. You know, but people have this idea that, you know, oh, you know, Amazon or Tesla or such and such a buy, you know, on this dip. Well, no, maybe gold is, maybe treasuries for one last hurrah down, because I think we're going to enter, you know, one more wave down of strongly disinflationary forces. And then I think inflation, you know, wins for a while. So that's a huge change for me. But, you know, looking at something like, you know, a yen hedged Japan, or maybe even in the UK, and people need to think outside the US and think outside 60/40 would be my final thought of the day. Because, you know, I think there's a lot more pain here coming up in the stock market, Adam.
All right. Well, very well said, Mike. All right. Well, look, for folks, at least on my channel, who weren't familiar with you beforehand, have enjoyed this conversation and want to learn more about you, follow you and your work, where should they go?
Mishtalk.com. And if you're interested in photography, if I can do a plug, I think I've got some world-class photography out there. Mishmoments.com, if you want to see some really spectacular stuff. And that's actually what got me out here. We escaped Illinois, moved to Utah. I'm within a few hours of like five national parks, having a ball here, really having fun. So I can end on a good note. I'm pursuing my dream, which is photography and travel, having a really fun time. And I still have a fun time writing my blog. And of course, Adam, it's always fun talking to you. Our relationship goes back how many years? At least a decade.
At least a decade. Yeah, exactly. Well, Mike, thanks so much for being such a good role model for everybody who's looking to get to your point in life where they can live their passion. And yeah, you live close to like four or five of the most beautiful national parks in the entire country. So, Mike, when we edit this, we will put the URLs to both those websites up on the screen. For folks that are watching here who, because this is also going to run on your channel, Mike, who aren't so familiar with this channel, this is wealthion.com. Actually, come to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/wealthion. That's where this interview is going to run, but we have daily interviews during the week with lots and lots of thought leaders, guys just like Mike. So if you're interested in that, go check it out if you like your daily dose of macro. All right. Well, Mike, look, so fun catching up. So fun. We finally got a chance to do this. Looking forward to getting a chance to do it with you again sometime soon. In the interim, I'll be following you on your website to get your thoughts on how the unfolding story here goes. And everybody else, thanks so much for joining us today. And thanks for watching.
And on Twitter, it's Mish GEA. Thanks, Adam. Look forward to the next one.